Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. GameStop, the physical video game retailer, is shutting down 200 stores across the country. And while most of its stores are profitable, the company's stock prices are falling. A sign to analysts that GameStop might be going the way of Blockbuster, the once giant video rental chain. Michael Futter is the former news editor of Game Informer and author of the 2018 book, The Game Dev Business Handbook. He joins us by Skype. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. GameStop, it's the largest video game store company in the world, but there are reports that it's in decline. Why?
Well, GameStop has long lived and died by its used game business, and that relies on packaged goods. And before the Xbox One and the PlayStation 4, especially this generation, physical media was the way to purchase games. There were some titles that came out day and date in digital format, but retail was largely the way to go. And when people were done with their retail games, they would go to GameStop. They would trade them in. They would buy new product. And it would be this virtuous cycle of putting product back into circulation in a secondhand way. And GameStop was pretty much the only player in that. There was, of course, the eBay, you know, traffics in that as well. There were used copies on Amazon. But GameStop was where people went for used copies. And it provided a good way for people who were coming into the cycle late. So if they were late adopters and purchased an Xbox 360 or a PlayStation 3, there was a library of games available to them, and a lot of them were used. Additionally, you can't easily return brand new games once they're open. So if you purchase a used game, didn't like it for the first week, return it, try something else. That model has been completely disrupted because of the advent of day and date digital purchases for every single retail release. So a full $60 game, which is full retail price on most games, then, you know, they're available to download and even preload so that people can start playing the moment they are available.
That's kind of like getting rid of the middleman, right?
It is. It's, you know, we talk a lot about Blockbuster as an analogy for GameStop. You know, you no longer needed to go to a physical location, browse the shelves, see if there were copies of a movie you wanted to see, then come home. Netflix, for instance, changed the way that worked. Even early on with their disc by mail service, digital and streaming have completely disrupted the way we consume music and consume movies. It was only a matter of time before it was going to disrupt the way we purchase, if we decide to purchase, and that's a separate point. But the way we purchase video game media has completely changed this generation. So starting in late 2013,
So how is that changing the culture of gaming then?
The culture of gaming has changed a lot. You know, there used to be this process and that many gamers understand, where you went in, you put $5 down on a video game. You walked into a GameStop. There were people who, depending on the location, were either very knowledgeable or perhaps not so knowledgeable. The best stores had very knowledgeable staff. And there were GameStops everywhere. They were very much like Starbucks. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a period right after they purchased EB Games where my local mall had two different GameStop locations. Yeah. There was one on the upper floor and one on the lower floor. That's not a sustainable model, especially as the move to digital has continued. So people have also shifted their perspective on free-to-play games. Fortnite, for instance, the largest game in the world. Minecraft is affordable. It's not free-to-play, but it's exceptionally affordable. And these are games that kind of grew up digitally. There was a while that you could purchase, and I think there are still some ways that you can purchase Fortnite physically, like in a box. But I think that those might even have download codes. They might not actually have game cards in them. So people have shifted their perspective on free-to-play, the way they're spending money on games. You know, it used to be you spent the money up front, you got all the content, you played that. It might have an end. There might be a multiplayer mode. You might keep playing a game. You might decide to trade that game in. But free-to-play games are driven, and it's this what we call games as a service. They're driven by constant updates and constant engagement, so that you're going to see players lapse, but there are always ways that companies are trying to bring people back in. Epic Games, which makes Fortnite, absolutely experts at this. They've teamed up with Marvel. There was an Infinity War mode that came up for a little while. They teamed up with DC for Batman's 80th anniversary, so you can buy Batman and Catwoman skins. And they've also shifted away from loot boxes, which is a think about opening up a package of baseball cards. You open this up, you have no idea what the items are going to be in there, and there's some controversy over them because of the way that they're set up and implemented and the connections to the way people engage with gambling. But Fortnite, when it launched its Battle Royale mode, which is the mode that everybody plays, they did a what you see is what you get. So they put these items up on the store and you know exactly. You're spending $20, I believe, for the Batman package, which I think has a glider, a skin, and maybe some what they call back bling, which is like a backpack.
Is there any value in owning a video game, a physical video game anymore?
I think there is. And I think there are groups like Limited Run, which is based in North Carolina, that works with independent developers to ensure that there is that there are copies of their game physically. The big example that I can think of recently, Nintendo shut down the Wii U eShop so that you had to download all of your games. And if you didn't, then they're lost. Even if you owned them, even if you paid the money for them, if they're not downloaded physically on your system, they're gone. Another one recently, when Telltale Games went through its shutdown, there was a lot of licensing issues. All of that company's games, almost, were based on licensed properties. So Microsoft and Minecraft announced that, hey, Minecraft Story Mode is going to be removed not just from purchase. It's not just that you can't purchase it anymore, but if you don't actually download this game, then you're not going to be able to play it anymore. So what I did was I went out, there are actually full copies of those games on Nintendo Switch on a game card. So I will be able to, without having those downloaded, be able to continue playing those. So I think there is a case for owning physical media. I think that there's always going to be a case for owning physical media. And we have every indication that the PlayStation 5 and whatever Microsoft calls the next Xbox will continue to play physical media. It's being de-emphasized not necessarily from the publishers and the console manufacturers. It's being de-emphasized because people are really embracing digital ownership. The question then becomes, what happens when those services shut down? How do you retain that media? How do you retain that ownership? What does this mean for archival purposes and for preservation, which is a constant issue in the video game world?
And what does it mean for GameStop? How is GameStop responding to this? Obviously, you know, the news is it's closed 200 stores, that its stock value has decreased. But what's it doing about it?
I think it's moved too late. GameStop, again, and this is the new leadership has admitted that it was built on this pawn shop model where people trade in video games. And there was a supply and demand aspect of it, because there's only so many copies that are ever printed of a game that there was always a way to get those games. Now there's an unlimited amount of copies of games. You can always go right to PlayStation Network or the Nintendo Switch eShop or Xbox Marketplace and purchase a copy of that game, even if it's out of physical circulation. So it disrupted that whole model, and GameStop moved very late. They attempted to go into consumer electronics. They owned a mobile phone company. They have tried a lot of different things. They owned a chain called Simply Mac, which I believe they're currently divesting. And they went hard into collectibles. So they started to transform the stores. And the stores used to be very clean, and it was video games and video game accessories and hardware. So you had controllers and headphones and those sorts of things. But then they purchased ThinkGeek, which was, on the surface, a very smart decision. They purchased a company that was well-loved in the community, that produced high-quality, really neat collectible items, and then they filled their stores with them, and the stores became very cluttered. And you started to see collectibles take up more and more of the footprint in a GameStop location. Well, what GameStop did was they sunset the ThinkGeek brand recently. This happened earlier this year. I believe it was right around E3, which is the big event that happens in Los Angeles every year. They started to sunset the brand, and then you had the community who was really upset. It's like, hey, we love ThinkGeek, but you're taking that ThinkGeek brand away and you're merging it into GameStop. What they're starting to do now is they've got this plan where they're experimenting with a number of different pilot stores. They've got one or two that are based on retro gaming, which is still very hot. They've got a couple that are based around esports. They are really hopeful that they're going to draw people in as a place to not just come in and purchase, but to hang out and play games. Now, we see that work in the tabletop world. There are game – those stores live and die by the events that they have, like Friday Night Magic and other organized play events. But what's not clear is what their plan is to convert the people who come in to play in an esports tournament into buying customers. Mm-hmm. There's no understanding of their plan about what to do with people once they've got them in the store for that kind of event.
The next, I mean, is GameStop the last game in town? I mean, is it the only one still standing anyway?
No, they are the only specialty retailer for the most part in the United States. But if you look at their Q2 financials, which covered May, June, and July, GameStop was down across the board pretty much except for collectibles, which isn't surprising based on their investment in ThinkGeek. But new hardware was down, new software was down, accessories were down, pre-owned sales were down significantly. The problem here is that if you compare GameStop, which to be clear is reporting globally, against the NPD's report on the U.S., because they only cover the United States, mm-hmm. GameStop was falling even lower than the whole market. So it's not just that the market's in a decline, and the market is in a softer place right now because we're getting ready for new consoles. Likely holiday 2020 is when we're expecting the PlayStation 5 and the next Xbox. So it's not just that things are softer right now. It's that GameStop hasn't made the right moves early on and early enough to compete with Target and Best Buy, who are continuing to sell in and sell through a number of titles, hardware, accessories, and all of that. And if you look at how Best Buy especially has changed and converted their video game section, it used to be in the back, now it's in the front.
Right.
But Target in particular, I want to point out, because they went all in on Nintendo Switch. They have big kiosks, big areas. You see it when you're walking down the main aisle. That's why Target's doing so well. So it's not that GameStop's the last game in town. Mm-hmm. It's that they haven't made the right decisions to keep up with what customers are looking for.
What kind of timeline do you see for the demise of the likes of GameStop?
GameStop's in a tricky position. They attempted to find a buyer and failed. So right now they're in the process of laying people off. They've had a number of rounds of layoffs. They're closing stores. They've changed the way their regional map works. It really all depends. To me, it seems like they are positioning themselves to be purchased. They're trying to put themselves in a better state to be appealing for a company to come in with an offer and, you know, hand everything off and go. My concern here is that if it's a cash offer, great. If it's a cash offer, you've got somebody who has a real investment in continuing the GameStop brand. And importantly to me, Game Informer as a magazine and an outlet for good video game journalism. But my concern is that if it's a leveraged buyout, it's the same kind of buyout that affected Toys R Us, then what you're going to see is the company saddled with debt that it can't service and ultimately collapse under the weight of it. So in terms of timing, that's hard to say. If they can limp ahead to when the next consoles come out in holiday 2020, that's going to give them a boost. They're going to be able to stick around a little bit longer. But if things continue the way they are, I'm not so sure when they run out of rope.
How do gamers feel about this?
I think gamers are mixed. I think that there are people – GameStop doesn't have – it doesn't have a positive brand image amongst a lot of gamers. And part of that is store experience. Mm-hmm. Part of that is walking into one of those stores and being overwhelmed by collectibles. So, you know, they're working on decluttering their stores, a word they've used. Mm-hmm. But I think that everyone realizes that losing a major retailer from the space isn't good for the industry. And I think that, you know, GameStop was a big motivating factor for Microsoft and Sony, especially to keep a physical media drive in their consoles. There was a while where Microsoft and Sony, there was this symbiotic relationship, a very tight symbiotic relationship between GameStop and the console manufacturers. I think that has become threadier. I don't know that Microsoft and Sony need GameStop as much as they did. And I think that consumers recognize that it's good to have a specialty retailer in the space, But I also think that with online purchases, digital, that there will be some pain amongst some people, especially where broadband access isn't quite as good, and downloading or broadband caps in particular make things more challenging for digital. But for people who aren't operating with caps, who have decent download speed, who have other retailers that are nearby, then I'm not sure that pain is going to be terrible. I think that from an industry perspective, we don't ever want to see a specialty retailer go. But from a brand perspective and from a consumer sentiment perspective, GameStop isn't terribly well loved.
Well, Michael Futter, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Michael Futter is the former news editor of Game Informer. He's author of the 2018 book, The Game Dev Business Handbook. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The future of manufacturing includes artificial intelligence. Ohio State University has opened a new lab focused on using AI in industrial settings. Michael Graber manages the new lab. He's an associate professor of integrated systems engineering and mechanical and aerospace engineering at Ohio State. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Okay, it's called the Artificially Intelligent Manufacturing Systems Lab, AIMS.
That's correct.
As it is called, it is designed to bridge the divide between manufacturers and academia, right?
That's correct.
How so?
It's really difficult for manufacturers to try things out in a quick turnaround setting. They've got their business product they have to deliver. They've got, you know, a lot of money invested in their capital resources, and to just try new things on a line is very difficult for them. But oftentimes academia, we're working on theoretical problems, not necessarily applied research. And so it's difficult to see how those theories can transition out. So this sort of sits in that gap between those two, where academic theories could be tried out in relevant settings and there can be near-term off-ramps to go out into industry, you know, so it's not a big revolution.
I thought AI already was a big part of manufacturing. Or is that just for the big guys?
No, I think it is. I mean, definitely more so for the big guys than, say, the smaller mom-and-pop shops. But it's being implemented just in different ways. A lot of times it's, how do I automate a repetitive task so maybe a person can be freed up to do another job that is a better use of their time? Things like quality control, you know, we can take pictures and do a pretty good job of automatically detecting defects and things like that. So you see, that's where it gets implemented a lot. And I think that's where sometimes people struggle with the difference between what I would classify as automation mm-hmm. versus something that I would say AI speaks more towards autonomy than automation. So is it a repeated task that's the same every time over and over and over again? That's automation. And robots are very good at that. And then there's, do I have the ability to think and make a decision and act on it? And that tends to be something humans are much better at. But with artificial intelligence, we're now offering that ability to robots to be able to think, being driven by data and computers as well.
Walk me through an example of the on-ramps and the off-ramps of this kind of a thing. How would it work? So a company comes to you, what happens?
Sure. So if you think of just like a process control, something as simple as you just want to detect whether or not your machines are staying calibrated and are they actually able to reproducibly do the process they're supposed to be doing. You could imagine I could put some camera systems in there to monitor the process and see how I'm doing. And a question that a manufacturer would have right away, I can go buy the top of the line camera that has all the bells and whistles, so to speak, and maybe it's $10,000 or $15,000 and I can afford one of them. Or I could go buy 50 webcams that are pretty cheap and off the shelf, and I could put those all over the lab and take pictures. Any one webcam doesn't have the quality of that high-end camera. But as a system, maybe they can actually provide you more value, not to mention if one webcam goes down, you still have the other 49, where if that one camera goes down, you're lost. Mm-hmm. And a mom-and-pop shop is not going to go out and buy both and run that test and see how it works. We now have a lab where those tests could be run, and academic theories on optimization, placement of those cameras, algorithms for integrating 50 cameras to give you one piece of data. That's an academic theory that they could be working on, but it could provide real-time, you know, suggestions to mom-and-pop shops of you'd be better suited to do this versus that. And they could collaborate together in this space to look at those.
What's the financial relationship between the companies that would come to you and Ohio State?
So that's a good question. So the lab itself sits inside of what we call CDME. So it's the Center for Design and Manufacturing Excellence. And it's a really interesting lab in and of itself. It has this mission. They sort of brand themselves as this shepherd through what we call the technology valley of death. They're sort of early on. It's a sort of a funny phrase, but early on, a new technology, whether it be quantum computing or artificial intelligence or, you know, genome sequencing, things like that, there's a lot of funding from academic institutes like NSF and various, you know, government agencies. And it gets taken to some level of readiness. We refer to these technology readiness levels to the point where it becomes uninteresting to them from a funding standpoint. It's not the new thing, but yet it's not technologically advanced enough for industry to buy it. They say, well, it doesn't work yet. Why would we buy it? Mm-hmm. And so there's this kind of period in time where there's no funding and no interest and these things stagnate. CDME sort of sits there in the middle and says, when industry comes and has a problem, we'll pull in the academics that could help solve that problem today. But if an academic has a really nice idea that they want to try to take to market, they help from that side too. And so this lab sits there and it's a place for companies to come in and say, we'd like to try this. And sometimes it's as simple as we're just going to buy some time in the lab, pay for the staff to run these studies. Sometimes it's we're going to have to actually pay for equipment and place it in your facility and use it. So there are a lot of models, but it's a user facility really from both sides, from academia and industry.
Is it expected to generate revenue for the university?
Yeah, so it's an interesting kind of model because they sit inside the university.
Right.
A lot of these centers don't. So they are sort of a nonprofit in that sense. Their goal is to just kind of break even and pay for themselves. They have staff, you know, they're trying to pay their salaries and things, but they're not trying to make a profit the way mm-hmm. an actual company would. I'm sure the university would like them to not lose money, but mm-hmm. they're trying to just break even. But their mission really is that, how do we take some piece of technology that's on this, you know, sort of transition path and just move it forward? They're not trying to make a product. They're not trying to target anything. It's how does somebody who has a need come to us and we just progress it down the line? That's their goal.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Michael Graber. He's an associate professor in the College of Engineering at Ohio State and co-director of the new AIMS. That's short for Artificially Intelligent Manufacturing Systems Lab. I think using AIMS is wise. who are you working with now? I mean, are there anyone up to bat right now?
From the company side, there have been another number of companies that were engaged right from the beginning with mainly donating equipment and things. So large companies like Yaskawa, who is a Japanese robot manufacturer, but their U.S. headquarters are actually over in Miamisburg, just south of Dayton. So we've been working with them. They've donated three of these large industrial robots. We have one smaller one. Companies like Crown Equipment, which is up sort of north of Dayton, north of Troy and Piqua area and sort of northwest Ohio. They are a big equipment maker, forklifts, things like that. So they're very invested in how can we use this lab to build equipment that we care about. And then a number of other small local businesses that we do work with, people that do tooling, Shunk, and a few others. So they've really embraced coming to the lab and saying, we can donate equipment, we can donate expertise, we'd like to work with you to see how you can help us do the things we do better. And then there's numerous academics across the university, obviously, that are engaged in the lab.
What about students?
The students, that's another thing. I keep singing the praises of CDME, but I think it's a really, really useful place both for industry and academia to meet. But then for the students, they get a lot of hands-on experience. They hire what they call these intern cohorts, and they hire kids in. And these kids aren't hired to work on one specific project, and when the project ends, they're let go. They're hired until they graduate, and so they're undergrads. They're attempting to hire 50% veterans, so I think that's a noble cause as well. And they bring these kids in, and they'll be working on 4 and 5 and 6 projects over their time, so they see a large breadth. And a number of them actually end up running the projects. They've got a staff person at CDME that helps them and goes through, but they get hands-on programmatic experience. They understand what are the trade-offs in a real business environment that you don't really don't get in academia. You learn the theories, but you don't learn practical, I would say, applications. So for that, the hands-on experience the students get, I think, is second to none. And there's no other manufacturing centers in the country that I see that are that heavily engaged both in real industry but also bringing the students in as well as they do.
You know, that's the thing. I mean, we hear about how higher ed has to start producing technology or knowledge or creating a knowledge base that responds to what they need out in the real world.
Absolutely.
And I was surprised that this is the first one of this kind in the country.
Yeah. I mean, there are others that have that model. They engage students. I just think when I have gone to visit, so I don't want to pass too much judgment, but when I've gone to visit, it's the student piece is quite lean. There are a few students there. They tend to be more on the graduate skill. So they're doing their graduate skill projects there and they're heavily involved. But the undergrads, when you go to CDME, they have an area and there are undergrads that are not, they're there doing their homework and talking with each other. And there truly is a kind of a cohort feel there that they spend their time there. You know, it's kind of almost a hobby to some extent. And so they're just constantly immersed in hearing real industrial problems come through, even if it's just water cooler conversations. I think that's invaluable for students that they get to see that.
How do you reach out to companies and get them interested in trying this?
So a lot of it, I mean, we already have a pretty good network, Ohio State being a big facility. A lot of academics are already working with these companies. We're constantly trying to do that outreach. As you know, when things get into the media, now a lot of people are reaching out to us there, but we're a very large number of nice articles and pieces written about the lab. And so we've been fielding emails coming in about asking how people can get engaged. So that's kind of a constant ongoing thing, just reaching out. I think we want to make sure it's known that we want to work with industry. We want people to come in with ideas and we'll figure out how to do them in this lab.
Do you envision this as mostly regional or and do you see others popping up around the country in the likeness of?
I think there are
practical.
Yeah, there are other places that are doing similar things. I think we've taken a slightly different model. I think our goal is to be not to limit ourselves to regional, but I think being a state, you know, land grant school, I think we have some mission there that we should be doing that. And so the small local businesses in Ohio, we should foster that. And that's, you know, when the lieutenant governor came, that's something that we talked about. But I think our model too is that this isn't exactly a manufacturing facility and certainly is manufacturing things. But when you go to most manufacturing facilities, they're very focused on the unit process. They're saying we want to improve additive manufacturing. We want to improve rolling or forging or whatever it is that they're looking at. And we've really tried to make this more of a, how do we improve the manufacturing ecosystem? You know, there's a lot of fear about AI and what could take over. How's that going to affect the worker? And so what you don't see in any manufacturing facility doing this kind of research is you don't see the psychology department that's monitoring the people that are in there working. We have all these cameras. We're going to be monitoring the processes. We could be monitoring the people, obviously, with some security concerns and things there, but and personal privacy. But we could be monitoring how people interact with robots. How do you, as the AI learns new things, how does it articulate to the human what it's doing to build that trust? So human-machine teaming, because I think that's really where we're going with AI. It's not automating people out of a job. I mean, some jobs may go away because of automation.
They already have. I mean, we know that.
But it frees people up to do other things. And I think, but how do we build that comfort level? Because it's interesting in certain fields, everybody accepts the AI and they're perfectly comfortable with it. And then in other fields, it's, oh, that's either taking my job or it's dangerous. And it's interesting. That's a psychological issue. Why do people feel the way they do? And I think that should be studied, but not in a toy problem. It could be studied right in our lab, and we have the data to do that. And we want those people to come in and study that too.
Are they interested in doing that? Is that something you've already had conversations about?
I think so. The ISC department, so the psychology department, we're trying to bridge those relationships now. But the ISC department itself that I sit in, the integrated systems department, is an interesting department in and of itself in that we have a manufacturing group that does what I do and focuses on manufacturing and material science and things like that. But we have an operations research group that's data analytics and machine learning, and they do a lot of the algorithm development and understanding optimization. But then we have a human factors group that has a cognitive systems group, and that really what they focus on is human-machine teaming. How do we have safe, robust, you know, systems? And so just in our department, there is a really interesting group of people that can look at this problem, and then they bridge the gap. Some of our faculty, their degrees are in psychology, so that helps bridge that gap. We can reach out to more people.
I'm trying to get a fix on how big it is. I mean, I know you told me what the square footage is and all that kind of stuff, but how many projects can you accommodate at once? How do you schedule this? How does it work? It's a finite space, right?
Yeah, it is. It's a good size space. I mean, 1,500 square feet to give some sense of, you know, it's a good size ranch home, I suppose.
Yeah.
I used to live in one. And so it's a good size space. We can fit, you know, tens of robots, and we can have furnaces and CNC machines and drill presses and foraging presses and things. So we can fit a lot of equipment in. I think when you start talking about how many projects can you work, that's part of the paradigm change that we want to see happen. You think of manufacturing as very much, you know, manufacturing lines. That's a word you hear, you know, assembly lines. And so you kind of say, this line can do one thing and this line can do one thing. And so you have a finite number of projects you can do. We believe we should be moving more to manufacturing hubs where you have equipment and projects are moving in and out. They're weaving and flowing through that hub in potentially very complex ways, being driven not only by the human, but the AI kind of working together. So now you start thinking of, if I have 50 spokes, I could have 50 projects going on at one time, because can they be coordinated? And you start thinking of, you know, how do we manage routing airplanes? It's the same thing, as the manufacturing cells are kind of like airports, and the components and the things moving through them are like the planes. How do you coordinate that and schedule that? We may be able to increase efficiency significantly. And so to your question, I'm not sure that I know the answer of exactly how many projects you can have, but I think we'd like to test that and push those boundaries.
Okay. Well, Michael Graber, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Graber is an associate professor in the College of Engineering at Ohio State. He's co-director of the new AIMS. It's an artificially intelligent manufacturing systems lab. We'll put a link to more information about that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The food delivery app DoorDash has joined the ranks of tech companies that have experienced a major data breach. The company last week announced that about 5 million users had their data compromised in May 2019. Joining us to talk about that and more tech news is Android Central contributing editor Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
All right. So this is the usual, the names, email addresses, delivery addresses, order history, phone numbers and passwords. When was DoorDash notified of the breach?
DoorDash was notified of the breach about a couple months ago. It was in May. It was around May 4th. Essentially, anyone who had, you know, joined and used the service before April 5th had been compromised. They were notified a little after April, and it was confirmed by the beginning of May. So on May 4th, they were able to confirm that the access had happened and that the damage had been done.
Has it been ongoing, or were they able to stop it?
They claim that they've been able to stop it. That it was just you know, people at up until April 5th. Anyone who has joined the service after April 5th have not been affected by the breach, according to DoorDash. But the breach is significant, not just for people who were using the service as customers, but also for people who worked as contractors for DoorDash. The customers had all of the usual data compromised, and including the last four digits of all of your payment cards, not the full card number, and not like your CVV number on the back.
Mm-hmm.
Just enough to kind of confirm that other numbers that may have been linked at another point were definitely attached to you. But there were, you know, there's a lot of information that people who work for DoorDash have to share in order to get paid and things like that. And that includes, bank account information for withdrawals and things like that, or for deposits. So a lot of information for people who work as contractors for DoorDash all over the country were also compromised.
Are they just finding out about this now?
You know, that's actually not clear how long the people at DoorDash who work as the contractors were aware of it. That's not something that DoorDash has specified. And I would assume that it's something that they probably knew about at the same time as everyone else, because I kind of figured that somebody would have said something at DoorDash had they have known for months that this is something that had been going on.
And people can find out if they were impacted how?
If you head to the DoorDash website, there is a way to confirm that your information has been compromised. But it doesn't get a whole lot clearer than this. If you used DoorDash ever before April 5th, 2018, your account has been compromised.
There you go, people. What does this say about the kind of security measures that DoorDash had in place and has in place now?
The information that has it in place now is, you know, it's still not immediately clear how the third-party access happened. This particular breach has been closed, but it really just highlights, you know, when it comes to a lot of these services, every time you create an account somewhere, you have to ask these questions. You have to ask, you know, what it is about this company that seems trustworthy with this information. It's not enough to just enjoy the feature that comes out or the function. You have to be able to trust the company with your data, especially when it comes to your credit card information. And when it comes to services like this, you really don't have a choice other than to hand over your credit card information. It's not like you can, also sign up for, you know, Google Pay rewards or Apple Pay or something like that. You can't just feed in most cases payment systems that you already have through trusted services. You have to kind of create a new service and add, you know, yourself to that payment gateway. So it's really, you know, it becomes an additional layer of trust that people who are creating accounts in places really need to start asking themselves before agreeing to create these accounts in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Does this, do we know how many people are affected by it?
4.9 million people,
oh my gosh,
according to DoorDash.
Are other...
So definitely not the biggest data breach, but not insignificant.
No. And other food delivery apps, do they operate the same way as DoorDash, where you can't use a middleman for payment?
Yeah, many of them operate in this exact same way, yes. DoorDash is definitely one of the more popular, and a lot of the other services started out as, early dine-in services where you could go and pick food up and then delivery was added later. So mm-hmm. it's a little more complicated. The payment services are a little different. But DoorDash started as this, you know, this kind of consumer service for delivery. And so it, you know, became very popular specifically for that feature.
Let's see. James in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, James.
Hi. Just a little bit earlier, you had mentioned that you were unaware of when contractors for DoorDash were notified about the breach. I had driven for DoorDash for a few months earlier in the year, and I just received an email from DoorDash on the 26th of this month, or I should say of September. And that was the first notification I got.
Wow. Do you know if you've been impacted by this?
It said that I had been.
Okay.
It mentioned, you know, all the things that you had mentioned, phone numbers, email addresses, addresses, didn't make any mention of a social security number, which is something I had to give DoorDash as a 1099 contractor. So I'm not sure if that's been impacted or not.
Mm.
I could forward you the email if that would be helpful.
Mm. No, I believe you, James. Russell Holly, I mean, so this is as much, people like James are as much risk as anybody.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
More.
And this is, you know, one of the really unfortunate things about the way that these services are set up is that, you know, they're really, really easy to start, you know, working for these things, like especially when it comes to things like DoorDash and Uber and Lyft and all of these services. It's really easy from a, you know, user interface standpoint to sign up and start working for these places. But trusting them with your information is challenging.
How is DoorDash responding at this point?
Right now, you know, there's been some limited offer of credit monitoring services, but not a, you know, and then there's a dedicated call center right now to help answer questions as people have them. But there's not a whole lot else, you know, aside from advising people to reset their passwords should they decide to continue using DoorDash. There's just not a whole lot else that gets done there.
James, good luck with that, and thank you for your call. We appreciate it. Microsoft Surface is kicking off there's a Microsoft Service event kicking off tomorrow. What's going to be different about this one?
Yeah, so Microsoft is refreshing its Surface Laptop line and Surface Pro line, which are going to be, you know, kind of modest hardware refreshes on the things that, you know, we've already seen. So if you like the Surface Laptop and the Surface Pro, you're going to see more capable versions of these with a few more features in that we'll learn more about tomorrow. But the really exciting thing about this event is a look at kind of the future for Microsoft through a project that they have been referring to as Centaurus. For a little while now, which is a flexible dual screen computer that Microsoft has been rumored to be working on for a really long time now. This is, you know, the idea, you know, not exactly the same as like a Samsung Galaxy Fold, but the same essential concept in that when you go to open this laptop, instead of having, you know, the traditional, you know, keyboard and trackpad and things like that, there will be this kind of dual monitor setup that we're going to learn more about tomorrow.
Hmm. Centaurus is. Do we know anything about the name?
No, this fits a long line of you know, kind of clever internal names that Microsoft learns, you know, kind of picks things for, and it follows a similar trend. The Xbox that was released earlier this year was codenamed Scorpio when it came out. So it follows, you know, kind of a trend from that company.
Mm. And there was a teaser video, right?
There was a teaser video that shows, you know, kind of a little bit about what to expect, but it's, you know, kind of everything in shadows and things like that. So not a ton going on. You know, obviously the goal here is to have things, you know, have everyone pay attention to the live stream tomorrow, which will be tomorrow afternoon as the event happens in New York.
Microsoft is emphasizing inking. What is that?
Inking has been something that's been available on the Surface line for a while, and it's the process of taking the Surface Pen and you know, making notes and you know, very quickly tracing things to grab screenshots and share them. It's something that if you are an avid Surface user, it can be very beneficial. It's super cool for taking notes in classroom environments because it will automatically convert to actual text that you can then copy and paste instead of having my horrible handwriting on a screen that I have to try and read later.
Mm-hmm.
One of the translation software that they use for translating actual, you know, written handwriting to text has been excellent for years now. It's one of the few things that really just doesn't have any competition in most places because of how well it works. But, you know, that concept is something that Microsoft has been slowly evolving over the last couple of years, and we're going to see a lot more things, you know, being possible through that pencil interface tomorrow.
There are some rumors that there might be a larger laptop involved in this. What do you hear?
Yeah, so I mean, this is, you know, we hear about this every year now, is that there's just a group of people who are very excited about some one company, you know, be it Apple or Microsoft or Samsung or HP, you know, going back to making a really nice 17-inch laptop, because everything for the last couple of years has been focused on, you know, kind of lighter and thinner and more portable. And that's great for people like me, but for people who want a laptop that they can, you know, develop on or edit photos and videos and things on, the larger screen really makes a difference. And so there's been a lot of hope that Microsoft will have kind of a larger Surface for people who want to do that kind of work, but also have the kind of hardware that Microsoft has been designing on with the Surface brand.
You wanted to talk about Minecraft Earth. It's going into augmented reality.
This is crazy. This is a very similar concept to Pokemon Go, in that you take your phone and you go out into the real world, and there's a game element thing that happens. But in Pokemon Go, you threw a Pokeball and caught a creature, and you could trade with friends and do things like that. This is the entire Minecraft interface, the entire Minecraft experience, where you build things and you know, dig around and collect materials. In the real world, you actually go with your phone out into the real world. You could stand, you know, in a public place in a park. You could actually build something in that park, in, you know, using Minecraft blocks, and actually leave it there for other people to find. So I could go to that park later on and see this structure that someone else has built in Minecraft, and actually explore it, you know, through augmented reality on the phone. Contribute to it if permission has been given to do so. There's a lot of flexibility there. It's really kind of an impressive concept, but it's taken a while for Microsoft to put it all together. Because Minecraft is kind of a complicated game, and it would be really sad if somebody tried to build a bridge in Minecraft on a road. so they have to make sure that it is safe for kids to use. So it's taken a little while for it to come together, but there's going to be a public release here in the U.S. Later this month, as it kind of slowly works its way out for for people to use and enjoy.
It is a great game for kids. I've played it. which says so much. But tell people, what is Minecraft for people who don't know?
Minecraft is digital Lego blocks for grownups. Mm-hmm. It's you know, you there are people who have built just amazingly fantastic structures. They've recreated, you know, entire buildings from Game of Thrones and from Lord of the Rings and you know, just incredible things that you know, you can kind of wander around and explore. There are people who have built early stage computers, input output computers using the technology that's inside of Minecraft, and just these fantastic concepts that take up, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of blocks to do. And then you have people like me that you know, are really happy to build a four-wall house and say that I'm done.
Right.
So there's, you know, it has been a creative outlet for you know, millions of people across the world to you know, put together some really fantastic things. And conceptually, being able to offer that in the real world is cool. I'm eager to see how that turns out.
It's not anything you win or lose at, though, right?
There is a what they call a survival mode, where there are creatures in the game that can come and attack you, and you can, you know, build more advanced tools to protect yourself. So there is an actual, you know, a gameplay mode where you can, you know, wander around and do things like that. But the more popular version of the game is the kind of creative mode where you can wander around and do things like that.
Hmm. Well, I look forward to hearing what your review is of that. Is any sense about timeline on this?
You know, we're going to have early access in October. The full game probably won't be available until later this year.
Okay. YouTube TV is moving to Fire devices. What does this mean? What's the technology we're talking about?
Yeah, so Google and Amazon have not been good friends for a while.
That's for sure.
You can't buy a lot of Google's products on Amazon's website still. There are some that you can. For a long time, the Amazon video streaming app did not include the Chromecast function on purpose. You know, these two companies have been at odds for a while. And over this past year, we've actually seen some of that go away. Amazon has started to support Google's Chromecast feature inside of its Prime Video app so that more people are using it. And now we're seeing the opposite end of that. Google is finally allowing its YouTube apps, YouTube, YouTube Music, and YouTube TV to exist on Fire TV stick and Fire TV consoles. So if you have an Amazon device that you use for you know, streaming video and things like that, as of yesterday, you now have access to the three YouTube apps that you can now install on your Fire TV stick and actually get the native YouTube experience instead of trying to, you know, sideload some really clumsy version of it that somebody else made.
What is this silly feud between Amazon and Google all about?
It's market share. You know, in order to ensure that that people are using the Prime Video app instead of some of the other services that are competing. You know, Amazon made it so that when you're in that app, you only have access to those things, and you know, thought that, you know, ecosystem lock-in was the way to success, that if you released Amazon things and you limited it to the Amazon experience, that you know, people would then just become strictly Amazon customers. And that blew up really terribly in their face, because the Google services is, you know, YouTube is the most popular video streaming platform on the planet, and you know, that was a counter leverage. You know, if you're not going to share our things, then we're not going to share our things. And it became this, what looked from the outside like a deeply childish feud between these two companies for several years.
Uh-huh. It costing them how untold amounts of revenue?
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, because the Amazon Fire TV stick is just deeply popular because it's so inexpensive. But at the same time, if it doesn't have YouTube, then it's pretty easy for someone to say, well, I'm just going to go and get a Roku instead, which many, many people did.
Mm-hmm.
And the cool thing about the Roku in this situation is that it's neither owned by Amazon nor Google, so both companies lost by having this silly little fight. So it's, you know, the whole concept of ecosystem lock-in just worked out really poorly for both of these companies.
I have not joined YouTube yet, even though it asks me to every day. What's the benefits of doing that?
Well, it depends on who you ask.
Okay.
There are some people who think that it is, you know, kind of the cultural exchange for the world. It is an education resource as well as an entertainment resource that is just kind of unparalleled. But at the same time, it has some really deep struggles with content moderation. Mm. And there's just a ton of people on YouTube who think the earth is flat. And that's kind of a problem for me.
Ah.
So it really there's a lot going on with YouTube. You, if you use it correctly and you kind of don't let yourself get stuck down a hole of nonsense, then there can be some really useful information there. But it's not for everyone.
Russell Holley, thanks so much for your time today, as always.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holley, contributing editor at Android Central. He's with us every Tuesday for Tech Tuesday. Thanks for joining us as well. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.